This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name's Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got one sponsor for the show, that's Jam Software, and I'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. Bradley, big week?
A very big week. We're on spring break.
Ah, we are about to start. I've got less than 24 hours till I am on break.
But, so yeah, we're on the end of it.
I'm counting.
We have had a wonderful spring break. I mean, just fantastic. The past 2 days have been spent trying to potty train my 2.5-year-old.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's been good times. So, yeah, of course, like long-time listeners of the show will remember when my middle son was born, because I think like months before that, your youngest daughter was born.
Georgia, yeah.
So she should be 3 now, right?
Yeah, she just had her 3rd birthday a couple weeks ago.
Okay. So, yeah, so Nate, my middle son, will be 3 this summer. So, yeah, we're working on the old potty training. And I've never potty trained a girl, and you have never potty trained a boy. So I hear that girls are much easier, and it has been fun.
Well, yes, we'll leave it at that. But yes, that is probably true.
Yeah, it's fun. You just make it till bedtime. So, yeah, that's been our spring break. But it's like one of those... You know, it's not going to be fun, but it's long-term, like short-term pain, long-term gain. So my other big project I have done over spring break, outside of like a lot of pressure washing, is I have completely automated my ordering of my toiletry items.
There you go. Tell me about this.
So I'm very OCD. My wife would tell you I'm very OCD, and I think through things in my head quite a bit. Like, and I talk about them, and I stress about them. And I've adopted the CGP Grey style of buying things. Whenever you buy things that are like disposable, you buy two of them. So if you buy a deodorant, you always buy two things of deodorant.
Yep.
And it's genius. Simple, but genius. And so my shaving gear comes from Harry's.com. Not a sponsor of the show, but fantastic. Only available in the US, I believe. But Harry's is a fantastic shaving experience. Really fantastic. So that covers my my razors and my gel. Now, from Amazon, using the Subscribe and Save program, I'm getting on various months, I don't get everything every month. Like, some of it's 3 months, some of it's 2 months. Floss, hair gel. I've styled my hair. I mean, And deodorant, soap, shampoo, and actually coffee. Now, I did coffee today because if I added one more thing to my April delivery, I get like 15% off the entire thing.
I'm just going to make a wee note of this as I'm writing. Yes. Going to come back to this later on. Yep.
And now I have also discovered that Amazon is now no longer like the air filters are something that I think are disposable because you have to replace those every so often, like every 3 months. I hate stopping at the store to buy them. But Amazon was always like they only sold them in packs of 6, and they were like $90. They only sold like the high end ones. Well, now I discovered Amazon is selling the more mid range ones, and I actually. From an energy standpoint, you're better off with the cheaper air filters because the more expensive air filters with their higher, like, they catch more things, actually make your HVAC unit work harder. So I wanted the ones that cover, like, pollen and dust. I don't need anything fancy. We don't have a lot of allergies, that we have to, like, kind of ongoing allergies that we have to worry about. So it's not on Subscribe and Save, but now I have it, like, I have a reoccurring wish list in my Amazon cart, which has now, like, air filter. It has socks, and it has undershirts. And
just instead of doing laundry, you're just going to keep buying new stuff.
Well, yeah. And here's the thing I'm doing with my socks, and this is going to show my OCD-ness. As right now, I have three kinds of socks, like black dress socks, brown dress socks, and athletic socks. All of my black dress socks were kind of getting old, so I just bought like 12 pairs of new ones, but they're all the same, so I don't have to match them up. And so now when my brown ones, when I get rid of them soon, I have a set that I'm replacing them with. They are all the same. So it's not like a multi-pack where they're all different kinds. They're all the same. Athletic socks, all the same. So if you lose one here and there, it's like not the big end of the world because eventually it'll just even itself out. And I've also, there is a certain kind of work pant I like to wear. I wear like slacks to work, but I sometimes can get a little dirty. So I don't like to wear like super expensive pants. So I don't know if you have an Old Navy store in Scotland.
No, we don't, but I'm aware of them.
Yeah, so I love Old Navy's. I think they call them like pre-worn slacks. They're like $20. They look nice, but they're not super expensive. So if I get printer ink on it one day, not the end of the world. So now I have like just bookmarked I know exactly the style I want. I know exactly the size I wear. And I just ordered like five the other day. Overhauling my pants.
This is now, the full overhauling my pants is a show title. I'm just going to write
all
that
in
down.
All in my pants, no doubt. There we go.
And this is a Steve Jobs strategy right here.
And then my jeans, I love the J. Crew outlet. Not the actual J. Crew because it's too expensive. The J. Crew outlet. So I love their jeans, know the size. So, and then I'm working on like J. Crew has some dress shirts I like to wear, and I have phased out polo shirts out of my life. I no longer buy polo shirts, like short sleeve collared shirts, mm-hmm. because they are only usable in the summer. And what I do is I just wear button downs year round now, and in the summer I just roll up the sleeves, so I kind of look a little bit hip. So I'm working on like kind of a standard.
You basically described exactly what I'm wearing right now.
All right. So I'm just trying to like make things like that. Like I don't have to think about that. Like, oh, crap, we're out of floss. If I need new pants, go to Old Navy, buy, you know, I think what I will do is like every August when school starts, just buy like five pairs of new Old Navy pants and get rid of the other ones. Like just rotate them out year by year.
That'll work. Yep.
So that was how I spent my summer break. And if
never let it be said, this show is not here to help people.
Yes. If you are ever questioning that I am type A to a fault, just remember these first 6 minutes of this episode.
So, other news, Casper Suite 9.9 came out today, 31st of March, and it now has support for all the iOS 9.3 stuff. So I have just got it installed about an hour ago and have been playing with it a little bit. And it's very helpful to have a child in the house who has a school iPad and brings it home. So I've been experimenting on my daughter's iPad for the past hour. Apple Classroom, working pretty well. Got that all set up and running. First impressions, really briefly, Bradley, it's discovery is pretty fast, right? It's based on Bluetooth discovery and then Wi-Fi. I found that it detected changes in the state of the student iPad very quickly, which was great. It'll be interesting to see how that happens when there's much more traffic around from multiple devices. But with one device in the room, it was fine. It detects things like whether the device is locked or whether the display is off and different things. And it updates the status of the student device on your screen. You can do things like you can launch apps, but you have to have the app on your iPad. So on the teacher iPad, you can say launch an app, and then it shows you the list of all the apps installed in your iPad. And then if the student's iPad has that app installed, it will launch straight away. But if it doesn't, I tried like launching the Airbnb app, for example, on April's iPad, which obviously isn't one that we deploy, and it just said, failed because the app isn't installed, which is quite helpful and useful, and will be useful in cases where like somebody's deleted an app that you've deployed, for example. I tried the screen observation stuff. It's not fast, right? It's not like you could watch a video across classroom screen sharing. It's not that kind of performance. But it's kind of like if you imagine you're using like a VNC connection over 3G, it's about that kind of speed. I think it's actually not even trying to send updates that fast. I think the client device probably sends updates once every like second and a half or something like that. So you don't see smooth 60 frames per second animation on your teacher iPad, but you do see major changes of state, which is quite nice.
And this is happening over the same protocol that AirDrop works, right?
No, I think basically that what AirDrop will do is it will use Bluetooth to discover the devices, and then it brings up a peer-to-peer Wi-Fi network to do the data transfer, whereas my understanding of Classroom is that it uses the same discovery protocol, right, as the Bluetooth discovery, but then it uses your infrastructure Wi-Fi to do the connection between the two devices, unless, and I haven't tested this yet, but unless you are in a place where there's no network, in which case I think it can do peer-to-peer as well. But I need to verify that. I haven't checked yet. But because I know in the requirements for Apple Classroom, it says you've got to have peer-to-peer traffic enabled on your Wi-Fi network. So I think that's part of what that's all about.
So I'm wondering, like, I'm thinking like in my office, like if you're in your classroom and someone texts you like, hey, kids having an iPad across the school, iPad issue. Could you, I mean, this theoretically, you should be able to remote in and watch it.
No, you can't do that. You'd have to be within Bluetooth range to even see it. More than that, you need to, at least the way it's implemented in Casper has had this idea of classes, school classes in the MDM server for a while. And what that is, a classroom is a combination of a teacher and the number of students. Like, this is for Casper Focus, right? And they've just basically layered classroom support on top of that, so it will extract all that information. If you've already got Casper Focus set up, as soon as you go to Casper 9.9, it will automatically enable, well, not automatically, you've got to turn on a checkbox in the settings, but once you do that, it will automatically deliver education profiles to all your devices. And then the teacher's iPad has to be enrolled as well. And the class has to be in session. So there's various sort of requirements you've got to put together. And we could probably do a show on this later on once I've got it all figured out as to exactly how to run this. But what I found was that I could see my classes, but until I set the what time does the class meet to include now, I couldn't actually see the devices. So there's all the kind of Casper Focus controls that are now applied to Apple Classroom as well. And that's quite interesting. That has implications for exactly how you set those things up. But even so, like I'm sitting in one room right now doing this podcast, and my daughter's like two rooms away in the house, and I can't see her iPad on Classroom anymore because we're not within Bluetooth range, even though we're both still on the same Wi-Fi network. It's not quite Apple Remote Desktop.
What we should do when this like is we do a show about it is you should record a screencast. We should watch it together and talk about it.
Yeah.
And then
throw it up on YouTube or something.
Yeah, and so when people are listening to the show, they could watch along with us.
Yeah, yep. As far as I can see, there was basically nothing much to do. Once I got the classes set up in Casper, because we hadn't really been using Casper Focus that much, once I set up a class with April's iPad as one of the student iPads and my iPad as a teacher iPad, then as soon as those profiles pushed, Classroom started working magically on my iPad, and as soon as her iPad got the push as well, did it need a profile? Not sure. I had to update it to 9.3, but once it was updated to 9.3, I was able to see her device, control it. Also, you can lock the screen. This is another feature of Classroom that's really good, and that is really fast. You hit the lock button and that device is locked straight away, and the same for unlocking. So it's really, really nice in that respect as well. So you could pretty quickly bring a class to order just by going pew, lock, and the whole place would lock, which is really cool.
Well, that's going to be the key, is like it needs to be 2 seconds versus 15.
Yeah, and it's got to be everybody and not just like 80%, you know, because that was always one of the kind of tricky things with Casper Focus was because it relied on push notifications, they're not sort of guaranteed delivery time. They're not sort of real-time notifications. So that was a kind of issue. And Classroom seems to fix that by going directly between the devices, which is pretty nice. Tried a couple of other things for iOS 9.3, one of which was that you can now put asset tag information on the lock screen of a managed device. So I created a profile to be sent to all devices that just said, this iPad belongs to, and then used the $ full name placeholder in Casper. And what that does is it replaces that placeholder with the full name of the user to whom that iPad is assigned in Casper. So I was able to get, you know, this iPad belongs to April Spears. And then with the same configuration profile, this is the same trick we were talking about recently to do with email configurations. That same profile will go to every other iPad and it will get the right name on it for the person who's got that iPad, which is really nice. And that's one of the reasons that's worth spending the time to set up users in Casper, because then you get benefits like that.
Well, and I'll tell you, one area that is hugely important is if you plan on reselling gear back to Apple at the end of a lease, they will not buy it back if it has asset tags on it. You know the asset tags I'm talking about?
Like a really sticky.
Yeah, it's like a metal one that you basically can't get off.
Yeah.
Apple will not buy back devices that have that. And so it's almost going to a digital asset tag. And I'm wondering if you could plug in the serial number on that, or other information.
There's a range of placeholders in Casper you can do that, and I'm pretty sure serial number is one you can do. Yep.
Yeah, that's okay. That's interesting. It's going to be a fun summer. I got the final numbers on my lease today, actually. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah, I think I should get my gear in May, or late April, early May. But again, I won't be able to touch our iPads until the summer, and all everything is good to go with like Apple Classroom. I kind of want to do it all once. Mm-hmm. Now my kicker is going to be like iOS 9.3 needs to be on all these things from the get-go. That's what I hope, but maybe not.
Yeah, I think we're going to get there. I mean, I haven't purchased any new devices since 9.3 shipped, but I believe, was it you that tweeted that there was in iOS 9.3, you can now update the iOS during the setup assistant if you need to for restore?
Yeah, I retweeted that from somebody else. No. Like it. So the problem that exists is if you get a replacement device that's, say, running iOS 9.2 and your backup of iCloud is running iOS 9.3, you had to go through this convoluted process of setting up as new, updating, reset all content and settings, and then you could set up and restore your iCloud backup. Very, very, very bad user experience that has really existed since iOS 5. And I am surprised it just took this long to get that fixed, because the solution wasn't making like backups be backwards compatible. It was just update in the process.
Yeah, just get that in line, that slipstream, which is really nice.
Yeah, so
it would be nice if that was just possible for all devices. You know, it doesn't. At the moment, I think it has to go through the backup path, doesn't it? So you have to go restore from backup, and then it discovers an incompatibility with the backup, and then it offers you to update. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So ideally, it would be, you know, is this device up to date with the current version of iOS as part of the setup, whether or not you choose new iPad or restore from backup, and that would be nice for us, because then we wouldn't have to care whether or not the devices in the boxes have got iOS 9.3 or not, because users would just deal with it as right. part of the setup.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And as if Apple begins to do things like including features and point upgrades, mm-hmm. it's even more imperative to be on the latest.
Yeah, with 9.3, I haven't really pushed people to get updated to new versions recently, but with 9.3, I'm sort of starting a push to try and get people to update their iPad to 9.3 just to basically so I can test out some of these new configurations before the holidays. Simple things, non-invasive things like can we push the asset tag to people's devices? Is that worth having? And so on. And also one of the things that happens with 9.3 is that if the device is supervised, it says so on the lock screen as well. And there's now kind of more, perhaps more frightening language in the settings. You know where you go into settings, general, about, and it says this device is supervised by, and it gives you your institution name. It now also says this device is supervised by Cedar School, and they can monitor your internet traffic and device inventory or something like that. It sort of explains a bit more upfront to the user what that actually means when it's supervised. And it also has a message on the lock screen that says this iPad is supervised by your institution. I think it is. There may be a field that we have to fill in with a new deployment to get more useful information into that part, but there's now additional messages on the lock screen for supervised devices.
Well, if we move on, let's thank our sponsor for the night. It's the great folks at Jamf Software. They have the Casper suite for Mac and iOS. And I'll tell you, if you aren't running an MDM at your school, it is just a core competency. It was funny. I was on a call. We're going through the E-rate process. I was on a call with a Wi-Fi vendor that also sells an MDM, and they asked what I was using for MDM and told them, and they did not say another word. I did say another word.
Yeah.
So Jamf provides tools that schools use to manage their Apple products, everything you could imagine, iPads, iPhones, Macs, Apple TVs. They do have an app called Casper Focus that allows teachers to quickly gain a student's attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to their class, and distribute iBooks. This Casper Focus is great, and the Casper Suite is great. And so if you're looking for people, a company that stays on top of the iOS updates, look no further than the Casper Suite from Jamf Software, because they have compatibility with iOS 9.3 out, ready to go as of this recording on the 31st of March. So check them out if you're getting a new deployment this summer. Here in the U.S., you can actually buy them directly through Apple as well. So it's really great stuff. You can build it into your lease. That's what we're doing. So check them out at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. So, continuing along with our Deployment 2016 series, we are at the part of the series where we're talking about cases and apps. So, this is really what we call accessories. Now, one of the things I recommend doing, if you can, is try to bundle as much into your lease as possible. So, like, if you know you're going to need volume purchase program money, you can actually build that into your lease. So, if you need $10,000 or $5,000 or even $1,000, you can build that into your lease. And the cool thing is, like, if you're coming, if you already have this nice library of apps that you already have in your managed distribution, you know, you'll get those back at the end of the year, and you can just top off with new stuff. You need to add 10 copies of Pixelmator. It's very, very easy to do. So, if you get $1,000 and you need a If a 4-year lease, it's not really adding that much to your lease payment in reality. It's, you know, dollars a month. So let's talk about cases. I think my recommendation is here is to just pause when you when your brain goes to getting a overprotective case for two reasons. Number one, and I would say the biggest reason is they're incredibly expensive. And if you have a large deployment, you could end up spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, if not tens of thousands, on cases. And it's just not needed, I don't think. I look at those Defender cases like buying AppleCare. It's not that they don't work. It's that you just don't need them in the grand scheme of things. I think you'd be better off to buy a much cheaper case, possibly less effective overall, but then just have backup iPads that you could buy with that money savings.
Yeah, I think that speaks a little bit to how quickly you can turn around iPad repairs. So if you are a long way from help, if you like, then maybe making sure you don't have to go through service might be a better option. But, you know, for me, who's got an Apple store 20 minutes away from the school, I can run up there after school one day, get the iPad swapped out of the Genius Bar. Sure, we're paying for it, you know, but there are, and certainly there, if it's a screen break situation, there are other companies who can do it cheaper now as well. So cases are, I mean, I famously, and I don't step back from what I've said before about cases, but I hate all iPad cases quite equally. So many little considerations that only come with experience. And now I can look at an iPad case and then go, kids are going to fiddle with that bit. Kids are going to break that bit. Kids are going to just be constantly flipping that bit on and off all the time. And I've yet to find the perfect case. But what we did was we bought a very nice case at the start of our lease. When we did our first deployment back in 2010, we said to people, right, here's a case from us. If you want to replace it with another case, that's fine. We don't care. But what I noticed was that almost everybody replaced it with a much worse case than the one we had bought for them. And that was the original Apple iPad case, if you remember that black one, which actually, in my opinion, is an underappreciated case. It wasn't lovely to look at, but man, it lasted and it worked. So what we said in the second deployment was, everybody uses our case, nobody gets to put a different case on. And that was fine, but our cases, the cases we bought, which were Belkin cases, they started to sort of fall apart by about the second year, and they started to look pretty tatty after the first year, but they continued to work. But now they've got a sort of magnetic clasp goes around them, and we've got like magnets falling out, and you know, the whole thing just sort of wearing away a little bit. So what we've done is we've replaced them with much less nice cases. We bought really cheap cases from Amazon, and because the form factor is going to change in the summer, we didn't want to spend like £30 on a case that we were only going to use for another 3 or 4 months. So we just put them in, bought 10 or 15 really cheap cases and kept them around. But what I'm looking at for the next deployment, Bradley, is I'm looking at a case that has a warranty on the case. And not everybody offers this, of course, but the STM is one of the companies that do. They have a case called the Dux case, D-U-X, and it seems to be, at least in the UK, this seems to be the one that is almost like the de facto standard case for iPad deployments in schools. It's got a kind of clear plastic back, it's got a rubbery frame around all four edges, and it's got a sort of flappy single hinged case. It's almost like a beefed up version of that original iPad case that I referred to. And the thing about the STM case is it has a lifetime warranty. So I'm wondering, you know, if our cases wear out or whatever, will we be able to get replacements? Because the question is, how much will it be? Oh, that's wear and tear. We're not going to pay for that. You know, it's not quite clear to me exactly what the terms and conditions of that are, but it would be nice if you could get a case that was like that, so that whenever, you know, one wears out, you could replace it with another one and get your replacement under warranty.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And if you've got, you know, if you've got small children handling them, Amazon, I know, has some cases with handles that make it really, really easy for kids to kind of carry them as well.
Mm-hmm. We had a case for our 5 and 6 year olds, which it closed up like a book, and then there was like 2 suitcase handles on the top, just small things, not full size suitcase handles. But kids would then sort of walk around the school carrying them with that, and it was very, very secure. And we have never had a 5 or 6 year old break an iPad in our school in 6 years. It's always the teenagers that do it, and it always happens at home. It almost never happens in school. So what can you say? It's going to happen, but a good case goes a long way, right? There have been situations I know of where people have bought really bad cases and they've had huge breakage rates, and then they replaced it with a better case and those breakage rates went down to sort of the normal. But if you're seeing above 3 or 4% breakage, I would be looking hard at that case, wondering if it was doing enough of a protective job. So I'm thinking that the STM case might be a better one. A couple of things to look for in a case, Bradley. One is that it encourages a good typing position. I made a mistake with this in our last deployment, quite frankly. We got a case that was like a kickstand case. And what that meant was that the kids could prop the iPads up like a laptop screen. And that kind of ruined a lot of the... Not ruined is too strong, but it took away some of that classroom benefit of having the iPad, which was the kids couldn't sort of hide behind it and make it like a barrier between the teacher and the student. And that all kind of came back with that case. So in our next deployment, we'll not be getting a case that does that anymore. It'll be a case that goes flat on the table in more of a kind of keyboard position. And that will also encourage better typing from the students as well. Because the thing about kickstand cases is they encourage a poor typing posture and very lazy typing fashion from the kids as well. So I much prefer cases that go down flat on the desk like a keyboard.
Yeah, that's a great point. And those are the tricks of the trade that you learn from experience that you're never going to read on a review or, you know, product description. You're not going to think about that.
No, not at all. No. Okay.
Screen protectors. I would never say this is like, do this for everyone, every iPad. I'll tell you one aspect I could see a tempered glass screen protector would be, let's say you're on year three of a 3-year lease and it's February and you get a crack in a screen, putting a tempered glass and it's still usable. Now, the thing about those cracks is once you get one crack, it's a whole lot easier to get more. And so if you put a piece of tempered glass you can get on Amazon for like $10 onto the iPad, it may be able to kind of, you know, patch it in the short term.
I have never deployed screen protectors in school. We don't have a specific policy against kids putting one on our iPads, and I'm happy if they do. But what I do say in the policy, and this is something listeners might want to take a hint on, is put somewhere in your policy that if you have to swap somebody's iPad, you will not replace their screen protector. I'm not saying Indy's ever given us a problem with this, but that's because I put this in the acceptable use policy straight away. And also, I explicitly say I'm not going to try and reinstall your screen protector on another iPad because A, that'll never work, and B, it's too much of my effort for basically no benefit. So it's not that nobody has ever put one on. I know a couple of kids have, but I don't really see the benefit apart from in the situation you said, Bradley, is a kind of diving save for an iPad that's already on the way out, which that could definitely be helpful. I know I have from time to time in a pinch used Scotch tape to hold together slightly cracked up iPad screens. We've seen a couple of situations with the fourth generation iPad where the screen, if it gets a kind of an impact on the face of the screen but on the edge, like on the bezel, that can kind of splinter a little bit, and I've been able to sometimes hold that together with a few layers of tape just until we can get a repair done or whatever, and that's quite effective from time to time. And you can also, of course, use a touchscreen through tape as well, which is helpful too.
Next thing is the Astolysis. Now, this includes all of the third-party ones, like I think Evernote has one. And then, obviously, there was the Apple Pencil, which is, I guess, the more Cadillac version. I would say, unless you're getting the Apple Pencil, most of them are garbage.
I would say, in a post-Apple Pencil world, all of them are garbage, quite simply. You know, once you've used an Apple Pencil, it's like, you know, going back to painting with a bloody stump on half your finger. they're so basic compared to what the Apple Pencil can do. Does it make sense to deploy them to students? Probably not. I found actually that I get at least good results personally and from the students by just writing with my fingertip on the glass screen than I do with using a non-Apple Pencil stylus. So that's a pretty damning thing. I mean, what is a stylus? A stylus is supposed to just simulate your finger anyway. So it's not as if you're getting a much more precise writing tip than you would with your finger anyway. So to me, they're not really worth it. None of them are very good. The Apple Pencil is very good, but of course it's £70-80 or $100 and easily lost, shall we say.
I think, you know, years ago, you and I called, we were talking about this, I think, on our last deployment series, that Apple would need to build something in hardware for a stylus to be really incredible. And not only did they build something in hardware, they actually built the hardware. So we were kind of right.
Yeah, nailed it. Yeah. It's funny, I was thinking about that today, you know, with that Apple Classroom. Like, literally the first time I ever spoke to somebody from Apple about our deployment back in 2010, the first thing I asked them for was, I would really like some kind of Apple remote desktop thing for iPads. How can we get that, please? And 6 years later, here we are, there it is. So we're finally there.
Oh, me. Time flies.
We are getting old in this game.
Next thing is in-classroom chargers. This is something I didn't think about, like, in on our last deployment series. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what I like is, that, like, Ankar has these, like, 5-port high-speed chargers that are, like, you can get on sale for, like, $20, $25. And depending on your budget and how many classrooms you have, it's not super expensive to throw one of those in every classroom.
They've got a 10-port version, though, as well.
Oh, yeah, that'd be fancy.
Yeah.
And the nice thing is that they are, like, high speed, and so, like, it's not like it's charging the it's not like plugging up an iPad Pro at with the iPhone charger. Like, these things charge at normal speed. That's the key. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a link in the show notes to one of those that you can buy, and then get, like, you know, get some Amazon branded Lightning cables in there, and you're good to go.
Yep, I'm actually thinking about doing exactly this next year. Previously, what we had done is we had basically taken the chargers that came with the iPads and put them in the socket bar and just left the cable, the charger from the iPad, left it in the classroom. Couple of things about that. One is the Apple cable isn't that robust, so some of them are starting to fall apart now. But also, they tend to wander away with the best will in the world. People always just quote unquote borrow a cable and that never comes back. So I just had to supply a couple of cables to a classroom where they had 5 chargers and 3 cables, and nobody knows where those other 2 cables are. So what I'm going to do with this is I'm going to get some of those 5 or 10 port chargers. I'll figure out how many I want, but then get cables for it as well. But here's the trick, right? Zip tie all the cables together, so that nobody can take just one away, right? That they have to steal the whole bunch. And whoever's walking around with 10 iPad cables hanging off their charger, you know they're the culprit. Maybe also zip tie it to a brick or something, I don't know. But I've fantasized about various ways to try and stop cables and chargers from running away from each other. And that's the first thing I can think of, is just try and zip tie or bundle these cables together so that it's not easy just to take one away from the block. That would probably be my first step along that line.
Yeah, we did the exact same thing you were doing last year, and I replaced those, like, with those Ankar units this year. Much cleaner, just, it's like kind of like, because it's like when you have, like, a surge protector and the iPad charger and the cable, you just got, like, you know, multiple things that can go bad. And in this way, it's like you either have the Ankar thing that's bad, if it is, replace it, or you have a cable that's bad, and if so, replace the cable. Like, you're eliminating one piece of equipment. So, next thing is keyboards. And I'm actually getting a, like, 20, Apple resells them, so I'm putting them on lease. I'm getting, like, 20 Lightning-powered keyboards in our next with our next lease.
Those are the Belkin keyboards.
Yeah, right? They're $70. We're getting 20 of them. So, I mean, we're getting 160 iPads, so we're getting 20. And we're going to be using them with tap typing. But, like, I don't think it's kind of like the stylus. I don't think you need one. You know, if you need one for every student, in some ways you may have the wrong device.
Like, you're certainly thinking about it in a slightly incorrect fashion,
right? But there may be times you need them, and so you know, it's nice to know that it works and they're available. And but again, I don't think you need to buy one for every iPad.
No, I mean, the situation, those keyboards, I've wanted to buy them for quite a while, and they have not, they have still not come to the UK. But one situation where they are beneficial in a secondary school would be in the exam room for students who get to use IT in their exams. We provide a Bluetooth keyboard for that, because we don't have that many students who do that, maybe 2 or something every year. But if you had more, say you were in a school, bigger school where you had 10 or 15 or 20 kids all using an iPad for their exam, then eliminating that kind of wireless traffic might be very useful, and just plugging something in. And I noticed, you know how there's this new adapter that came out with the 9.7-inch iPad Pro, which is a It's a lightning to USB adapter, but it's got a power pass through in it as well. What it can do, you can actually plug in a wired USB keyboard of any kind into that adapter with a power supply, and then that will work on the iPad as well. So this is something, another thing we've thought about in the exams is what happens if the iPad battery runs down. I mean, it's unlikely to happen because, but it's just a nice kind of reassurance for the student to know that there are things plugged in that's not going to run out of battery in their big exam or whatever. So that's something, that's another option. I mean, that's kind of a slightly complex, and you're probably cheaper trying to buy the keyboards, to be quite honest. But if non-wireless is important to you for whatever reason, then that's another way you can get that if those keyboards aren't available to you.
Next question is, does it work with a mouse?
Well, iOS has no cursor, so
I wonder if it would even, I'm sure, I guess it would turn on, but
Well, do you know what I do know is I know that that Bluetooth, that USB adapter does work with things like barcode scanners, because a barcode scanner, a USB barcode scanner, basically just emulates a keyboard. Now, that's what it is inside in USB terms. It's a keyboard. Now, it's not a keyboard. It's a laser scanner. But it basically just types whatever's on the barcode into your iPad through USB. So you can now plug a barcode scanner into an iPad, wired keyboards. And I suspect, I talked about this in my recent appearance of Mac Power Users, certain of those RF keynote clickers, you know, the things where you plug in a little stubby USB thing into your computer, and then you can use that to do your presentation. If the keyboard shortcuts are the same on your clicker, then you could actually use that on an iPad now as well.
Oh, interesting.
That could be a big deal. I need to find one that has the right keyboard shortcuts for Keynote on iOS, but I believe that does work.
So next thing, I guess final thing, apps and accessories, is apps. And mm-hmm. Now, here's what I'm going to say about apps, and I've said this many times. And the analogy I came up with before we recorded is that it's like if you find a new author you like, or a new band you like, and you go to the bookstore and you buy like all 15 of their back catalog, and you get them in the mail, and you like don't even know where to start, and you just, it's almost overwhelming that you have 15 books to read. Like I don't know about you, like when I have 15 books, I feel the pressure to read 15 books, and that's one of the downsides of physical books. With digital books, you just don't look at the your library.
Yes, as my Kindle back catalog suggests.
Yeah, you're working on your 2010 purchases right now.
Yeah,
so. And like the same thing with an artist, you add, oh, hey, I like this band. I'm gonna add all six of their albums. Well, then you feel like this pressure, like, is there a right order to listen to them in? Like, you know, which is the best? Have they changed along the way? I think like when you find a new band you like, just pick one album and listen to it. Listen to it twice, maybe get a feel for it. Then maybe go on to the next one, and so on and so on. And I think apps should be treated this way. Don't overwhelm people, because if you hand a teacher an iPad with 30 apps on it, they don't even know where to start. So give them, like, pick out your core apps for your school, master them. Then you can add some auxiliary apps along the way, but master your core apps first.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think the only caveat to what you've just said there, Bradley, is I don't know if I feel like there's a phase that every iPad school goes through where everybody goes mad for apps, and teachers will download apps and download apps and download apps. And then through experience, they will start to learn how to evaluate an app. I haven't really cracked a good way to teach this yet. I've tried talking about it in terms of things like which apps are applicable to all different kinds of higher order skills or whatever. And that sort of works with people who already know what they're doing with an iPad in the classroom, but people who are brand new, I feel like sometimes, like you can do that with the best will in the world, and I think what you're suggesting is a right approach rather than for the school to impose tons of apps. But the teachers will go nuts anyway. But over time, see, like our teachers now who are, you know, 6-year veterans of teaching one to one with iPad, they can look at an app in a heartbeat and go, that is brilliant, or that sucks. And I remember in years past, they would ask me, "Oh, I found this thing. Can we put it out on all the iPads?" And then they would use it for like a week and never use it again. And we're much, much better at evaluating that now than we were before. But I think that's something that just comes with experience.
So a couple that, you know, you're going to say, you know, again, this is not saying you're going to need all of these, but these are just examples of some that might be in your core toolkit. iTunes U, and we've talked about that extensively. Love Google Drive. Yeah. If you're a Google App school, you obviously use Google Drive, and I believe it finally got some iPad Pro features. Finally.
Yep, Google Drive. The Drive app specifically now supports iPad Pro resolution and split view multitasking.
And next thing is one of our old favorites, Explain Everything.
Mm-hmm.
Book creator app.
Have you used that before?
I have not. I've heard about it, but I have actually not used it myself.
I'll tell you a little bit about Book Creator. It's really cool. It's basically an EPUB editor for iOS. And what you can do is you can create books in it, and then when you're done, you can export your work as an EPUB file and open it in iBooks. And you can get an iBook. And I know there are books on the iBook store that have been made with Book Creator. You can place text and images, and you can record sounds and put them into your book as well, and different things like that. It's really, really impressive. We've used it for many years for different purposes. Big applications are things like kids making their own French language vocabulary books, where they record themselves speaking the words and things like that, and then the book can speak back to them as part of their practice. Things like that, you know. Gathering kids' sort of diaries as they go through a project, they can speak into their diary or write in their diary and so on. Those kind of things are really powerful applications of Book Creator.
Oh, yeah, sounds neat. It's one of those I've heard about for years, we've just never had a use for it or never needed to deploy it. Next thing is a good note-taking app. I mean, there's plenty of options here. Notability is a good one. Chris, there's also Apple Notes. And
Very broadly used in our school, I have to say.
And one, I'm using it. I have quite a few notes in it. A lot of them have images. I love it in 9.3, how you can secure notes with a passcode or with Touch ID. That's fantastic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Next one that is possible is Pages. Now, Pages is a pretty good word processor. It stinks that it still costs schools money. Because, end users, you get it for free, like when you basically activate your device, but schools don't get to do that.
Yeah, the rules are complicated around that, and sometimes it's worth talking to your Apple rep, like, can you get comped the number of licenses if you have an institutional deployment? Basically, the rule is that the first person to activate a brand new iPad gets a free license for all those apps. So if you're the second person to activate an iPad, even if the device is restored and it's a new Apple ID and everything, it's not every new Apple ID gets a copy, it's every Apple ID which is the first to activate a new iPad serial number gets a copy of those apps. So Pages, Keynote, and Numbers, same thing.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, it's a good point having a
and iMovie for that matter. In GarageBand.
Yeah, I've bought iMovie. Very frustrating. But of course, Keynote's a good recommendation.
Keynote is amazing. Can I just Keynote is to me such a versatile iOS app. I mean, the things I have done in Keynote in my school with kids is just it's borderline HyperCard, some of the stuff you can do in Keynote. You can't program it, that's correct, but you can certainly build navigation structures in it. You can build hyperlinks in it. You can do the basic presentation stuff, but I've also seen kids adapt it for other things like making their own flashcards for revision, things like that. Really, really, really powerful app. One of the absolute fundamental apps for any iOS school, I believe.
And a new one that's really fantastic in a lot of ways is Microsoft Office.
I've made my peace with this topic, Bradley. I'm not a huge fan of most of what Microsoft does, but I've kind of being forced is a little too strong, but I certainly had occasion to use Microsoft Office a lot more this year. And it has been, in general, very good. It has a couple of quirky bits and some of the kind of unusual interactions that can happen with it get a bit weird. Like if you airdrop a file to a student and they've already got a file open in Word and then it tries to open another one, it can get confused sometimes. But in general, and in terms, particularly in terms of like rendering an Office file, it's very, very faithful. Even for features of documents that you can't actually edit on iOS, it will still show them to you, which is fantastic. There is a weird thing though, Bradley, about what are the licensing rules around Office on iOS? And this is the most Microsoft thing I can think of, which is that if you have an iPhone, an iPod Touch, or a 9.7-inch iPad or smaller, you basically get to create and edit documents for free on iOS. And it's only if you have an iPad Pro, a 12.9-inch iPad Pro, do you have to have an Office 365 subscription to even create documents with the app? Yeah,
that's kind of confusing.
It is, yeah. But what it does mean, though, is that essentially you can sort of have Office for free if you have a 9.7-inch iPad deployment in your school, which is really nice, actually, if you think about it. There are some restrictions with the free Microsoft account, first of which is that you don't get any OneDrive storage space. Some people might consider that to be a benefit rather than a drawback. I couldn't possibly comment on that. But there are some other feature restrictions in the apps if you're only using the free version. So I just copied and pasted them here because they're kind of weird. Where you find them is kind of weird. But in Word, you cannot insert section breaks. You can't have multi-column layouts. Customizing headers and footers for different pages, changing the page orientation, track changes, custom colors for shapes, word art, shadows and reflection styles and pictures, adding and modifying chart elements or highlighting table cells with custom shading. Those are features that you cannot do in Word and iOS if you don't have a paid 365 subscription. In Excel, you're missing customizing pivot tables, adding custom colors to shapes, word art, again, shadows and reflection styles, and adding and modifying chart elements, which might be more of a limitation in Excel than it is in Word, quite frankly. And then in PowerPoint, seeing your speaker notes while you present is a big one that you don't get. Custom colors to shapes, word art, shadows and reflection styles, chart elements, and highlighting table cells. So there's a small subset there, which is the same in all three apps, and then there's a couple of features in each of the apps that you don't get unless you've got a paid subscription, even on a smaller iPad device.
I would say no word art would be something I would want to withhold from everyone.
Some of these may be features, yeah. Pivot tables may also be one of these things, I'm not sure. But yeah, Office on iOS, I think, is really important. And what it's done for us, like for myself and for a couple of teachers in the school, is to enable us to spend a lot more time on iOS, particularly when we're interacting with external agencies through school. If somebody sends you a Word document and you've got to be able to render it and print it perfectly, you can now do that on iOS. It's really cool.
A couple other ones that I'm a big fan of. And again, if something's not listed here, doesn't mean we don't like it. But I think the key is find the apps that your school needs and focus on those. Pixelmator is a great one, and if you can find it when it's on sale, I mean, I think at Christmas they had it on sale for like $1. Mm-hmm. Go into your VPB store, buy 500 copies.
Yep, absolutely. And also, pro tip with that, developers are going to hate me for saying this, but sometimes when a paid app goes free for a special time, load up on that, right?
Oh, yeah. And
there are sites that will tell you when paid apps go free, and just keep your eye on them. And when things go free, just pile into VPP.
5 million copies.
I have a couple of apps that get 5,000 copies in the end. I wouldn't recommend doing that many, actually, because things get a bit weird with the VPP store when you've got quite that many licenses for one particular app. It takes a long time to generate them all. So I just put in like 3 times the size of my deployment, right? 300 or something, which is way more than... If I ever need more than that, I'll be happy to pay for it because I'll have the money I need for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Another one that we love is Spelling City. If you're in elementary school, Spelling City, it's attached to the Spelling City service, a great spelling system. Mm-hmm. Apps are great. Students get their own individual login, and then parents can, you know, you can do it on the parent's phone. Like if they're, you know, brothers at a baseball game, they can work on the spelling in the stands, and really, really good app.
Good stuff. A couple more that we like from the art classroom, and one called Art Rage, ArtRage, as in Fury. That's a kind of physical art material simulator. It's quite a good experimentation tool for students who are nervous or reluctant to try things like oil painting or strange techniques. In traditional art materials, they can sort of practice or rehearse those skills in a simulator, and then they can do them later in the real world, which is quite a cool way to work. Procreate is an app whose name I don't love. I think it has connotations that I prefer not to have in school, but it is undeniably an incredibly powerful pixel-based art tool, and we use that routinely now for all kinds of art at all different levels throughout the school. It's a really, really powerful app.
Coach's Eye is another one that I really, really love for PE class and for sports as well. Gosh, mm-hmm. I wish something like this had existed when I had been playing baseball growing up.
Yep, Coach's Eye and iMovie are two incredibly powerful tools, along with just the camera as well. I mean, I did a presentation a couple of years ago at an Apple event where I was just talking about video for assessment, and I think that as an assessment technique, video is something that is only barely being explored in schools. And it's PE teachers, you know, Coach's Eye, absolutely. It's PE teachers that are at the absolute vanguard of doing this really well. And I think you think back to the kind of assessment skills you had as a teacher when you were in school and what your teachers had, you can now have in school the same kind of tools that like professional sports teams have got. You know, it's incredibly powerful. And we have used similar tools also to do things like for public speaking. We do video assessment for public speaking as well, because that's something that students can benefit from rehearsing and then looking back at their own performance and trying to improve the next time. And we also have used it for things like reading as well, and singing and elocution, where you actually video the student reading or singing or speaking and then play it back to them, and you can work with them on what they need to improve for next time. So video-based assessment is really, really powerful. And that actually links back into the Google Drive thing, which is video for assessment is great as long as you get somewhere to put all that video. And for the first few years, when we had the video cameras, we didn't have unlimited Google Drive. We were sort of like, well, you know, we can shoot this video, but now our iPads are full, and what are we going to do with it? And we didn't really have a solution. But now that we've got unlimited Google Drive, it's an absolutely wonderful system. You just dump all those videos into Google Drive, and you're done. So there are some really nice workflows around that available now.
Yeah, I think I sent you a text, but it's worth talking about on the show. You know, in Google, you can go in there and run like audits about like who has your highest drive usage, and it does it in megabytes. And I did the calculation. I have a user with 9 terabytes of storage in Google Drive.
Whoa, not even I've got that far yet.
Well, the thing, it's like it's media, it's movies, is what it is. Not like bootleg.
Nothing
movies
else can come close,
right? It's like concert movies, like where they've done trips and things and done like a choir tour, and so it's like a lot of like files that are one file. Like he might have all the files are 2 gigabytes, and he's got years worth. And but you know what? It works. I mean, like that's what it's there for. When the Google like interface kind of hasn't. It still shows like percent full, and like his is like goes in, it's like in the negatives as well. It's kind of funny, it works, and my gosh, it's free. Like why not? And they give unlimited. They obviously meant it, and he thinks when he's all said and done, because he's like uploading stuff. Like he starts a batch of uploads when he leaves every day, and like he has an iMac in his office that's an older one that's just wired into Ethernet, and he just like uploads. He has like a FireWire drive plugged into it. And he just is like uploading stuff because he had his stuff on like old external hard drives. And I chastised him saying, you have no backups of those. If these die, you're dead. And so he's uploading them slowly. So he'll batch them at 5 a night and just, every time he leaves, drops them into Google Drive from the web, from the uploader, and then, rinse, lather, and repeat.
Yep. It's not fast, but it is reliable. And that's much better than having something that's fast and unreliable.
Yeah. Google Drive is like my web OS in some ways. Like I know on iOS it has been okay in the past like 8 months. It has not been perfect. And I've looked at a lot of different options, and I always come back to Google. And there are a few reasons for that. Number one, everybody's got a Google account. And like everybody having a Google account is like everybody having Word like 10 years ago. Remember you did Word because everybody had Word. And it was like the universal file format. And in some ways, like your Google account is becoming the new file format, because you just can share it. Even if they don't have a Google account, you can share it without requiring them to sign in. And again, like if you look at all the options out there, just like what has the mix of power, but also simple to get started with. Mm-hmm. I've looked at all the options out there. Nothing still beats Google Docs. I mean, our entire show, every show notes we do, it's in Google Docs. Like there are... Now, if you're an iOS-only person and you say, I want the best like online document editor for just that's iOS, I only use iOS, it's probably not the best. I would say that like something like Quip. Have you used Quip before?
Yeah, we use Quip for the show notes on Canvas. Yep.
Yeah, so Quip on iOS is fantastic. I think Quip on the web looks like garbage, and it's very complicated to use.
I've only ever used it in iOS, and it has its quirks in iOS as well, to be honest.
Yeah, it really works well. Mm-hmm. But it's like, say what you want about Google. I mean, it's just easy to use and it works. I'll tell you, like iCloud collaboration over like Pages is garbage for 2016. If let's say you were in the web interface and I was in like the Pages on the desktop or on the iOS app. If I make a change, it takes a good 15 seconds for it to appear to sync up, and you actually on the web have to refresh the page to see that.
That's not how it's done. No.
No, not in 2016. That would have been fine in like 2010.
Just about.
And now the desktop apps take 10 to 15 seconds to get your changes, but they at least like just appear. Now, and that's inherently the problem with desktop-based document apps is they're not always online, where like a Google Docs is like web first. And I think that is what has given them the benefit all this time. Yeah, they're not perfect, but they're web only and they're web first.
Well, the thing about Google Docs is they've done the hard part first, right?
Yes.
Which as far as I can see, is this collaboration stuff, because neither Apple nor Microsoft can really get this right. I mean, you want to talk about a poor concurrency model. I've been able to get edit conflicts with myself on OneDrive on iOS, which is like, how does that happen? You know, I really think that with Google, they've done the hard part, and complaining about the lack of, like, you know, I don't know, a certain kind of footer in Google Slides, it's kind of small potatoes compared to, well, they've done the bit that nobody else can do yet, which is the live non-conflicting collaboration features. And then they can roll out, and they are rolling out these other things. I mean, even though we've complained about, you know, some of the Google Docs and Sheets apps not being up to scratch on iOS in recent years, they have still been adding new features. Like the Sheets app just got an update where you can now apply filters to your data on iOS, which is something that we've been using on the desktop for years and have really missed on iOS. And now we can do that kind of stuff as well. So those apps are still progressing, but they've done the hard part, and that's, to me, that's why I want to stick with those.
Yeah, it's even their conflict resolution. I don't know if you try that on Google. It's really good. And you're asking, where do you find conflict resolution? Well, if you have offline documents, and like I was running some tests, and I just want to see how this worked, and I had a meta document offline on my phone. Put it in airplane mode, went type, was typing at the same time on the desktop. And I actually erased stuff. It merged the changes gracefully, and it's very easy to see the revisions and see who changed what and to restore them. Like it keeps revisions for 30 days, and you can even mark don't delete revisions. It just works really well. Now, would I say that Google Docs is the best word processor in 2016? No. I hate to say this, like Word 2016 on the Mac, really, really good. Mm-hmm. Like it's really, really good. But again, to me, there's a difference. Like what's the best online document editor versus what is the best document editor? There's a difference there.
Yeah. I mean, for me, all the Google tools they're all about data, right? They're spreadsheets as data, they're text as data, they're slides as data. And they've got the data merging stuff working fine. Is it the most beautiful one? No, but it does a thing that nobody else can do, and that's, to me, that's a job that needs to be done as well. You know, would I use Google Docs to, you know, make a beautiful newsletter to send to our parents? No, and that would probably be Pages. But you know, if I have report cards to write, am I going to have everybody emailing Pages documents around the school? No, I'm going to make one Google Doc, and everybody's going to edit their bit of it. That's how that's going to work.
Yeah, it's like it's just different tools for different, you know, for different objectives.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly logical and sensible at this point in history, I think, to have all three Office suites. And you don't have to commit to one. Because you buy an iPad, you get iWork for free. As long as your iPad's not too big, you get Office basically for free as well. And if you sign up for Google Docs or a Google account, you get Google for free as well. You know, this is the wonderful thing about it, is that these aren't, it's not a £500 investment you've got to do anymore and make your decision which side you're going to go on. Just, I'll have them all. I'll use whichever one's best right now. Works.
Yeah. For, you know, pick the whatever I'm doing. It's kind of like I have multiple types of screwdrivers. Different ones work for different things. So, all right. I think it's a good place to end it for this week.
I want to throw in just one more app, if that's okay. A really good PDF editor. And the one I love is PDF Expert.
I'll second that.
And PDF Expert can do stuff on iOS that no other app I've seen can do, right? Presumably, if you had like Acrobat Pro from Adobe on the Mac, you could probably do this stuff. But like being able to, you know, batch rotate pages inside a PDF, extract pages into another document, reorder pages, play a bit with images, OCR the text, different stuff like that. I mean, it's really, really powerful. Tabbed interface, you know, Apple Pencil support, highlighting, comments, all of this stuff. I really, really, really love PDF Expert for iOS. I'm a huge fan. And I think it's something that certainly every teacher and probably every student as well should have as part of their system.
Yeah, great app. Great app. I'm going to leave you with one home repair tip that I gave someone last night that they said that was invaluable. And this is kind of out of nowhere. So let's say you've got an old home or an old school and you have the door hinges, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, even in your interior doors. What happens if those holes get too big for the screws? Do you know what you do?
No idea.
So what you do is you go get a box of toothpicks, jam them in there as full and as far in there as you can go, then break them off so it's flush, put the hinge on, and the screw goes in just fine.
Huh. I would never guess that.
Yeah. It's a little pro tip for the day.
This is the most helpful show we have ever done.
I know.
Between your toiletry ordering tips at the start and your home repair tips at the end, what a show this has been.
I think that's a good place to wrap it up for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Be back next week with another addition to our Deployment 2016 series. Getting closer and closer to the end. Closer to Fraser and I having new gear to play with. And if you haven't, let's review on iTunes lately. That'd be great. iTunes.com/out of school. I'd love to connect with you on Twitter, at Bradley Chambers on Twitter, and my blog, which I sometimes write at, is chambersdaily.com.
Okay, and I am Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
And if you love Fraser's voice, which you should, because if you listen to our show, he has two podcasts. Another one you should listen to, it's relay.fm/canvas. Mm-hmm. And you should also check out his appearance on, I'm assuming, the most recent episode of Mac Power Users at macpowerusers.com. And it's also on the Relay FM network.
Yep. I think the Mac Power Users episode will be out yesterday if you're listening to this on the day that this show comes out. I think it comes out this weekend. So it's going to be the 2nd or 3rd of April. So it's Mac Power Users and it's me.
Yeah. So again, check out both of those shows at relay.fm or in your favorite podcast app. So thanks for listening, everybody, and have a great week.